listeners, we are in part two of our conversation with Dr. Laura. If you didn't get a chance to listen to the first part, we highly recommend that you do. We are going right back into the conversation and starting with listener questions.
Well, actually, not starting with listener questions, because I still have some of my own personal questions to ask. And then,
okay, never mind. Not starting. We're starting with Molly's questions.
Molly's questions. So, I'm just like fascinated with the kind of therapy that Dr. Laura does, and we really got into it in the last episode talking about somatic experiencing and the nervous system cycle that we go through when we're activated in that fight, flight, freeze, fawn response. And we talked about Rachel having a personal experience of something that happened. And I dipped into this a little bit in the last conversation, but I do want a little bit of resolve because I'm trying to figure out how to resolve this in my life. In our last episode, we talked to Dr. Rachel Bernstein. She had asked us about like what symptoms of religious trauma are we ourselves experiencing. And for me, one of them is that I have nightmares, and they all kind of take place around feeling misunderstood. Like people are accusing me of lying. They're gaslighting me. I'm feeling like I have to defend myself. It's all very like interpersonal relationships. A lot of it has to do with like family members. And feeling like I always like wake up in like a cold sweat. My body is very tense. Like I need to like punch something or someone. And in the dream, I'm always in a state of like hyperactivation. Like I am ready to fight. And then I find myself dropping into like people pleasing and, or just freeze responses or just feeling incredibly frustrated. So I wanted to talk to you about like, maybe like what, if I was your client and I brought this to you and I'm like, I am having these nightmares. And for a long time I self-medicated so I wouldn't dream. And now I've like stopped. So they are a lot less frequent now that I've been talking about my trauma, but they do still happen. So I just wanted to get your take on like this experience that I'm having. I know that a couple of my siblings also experience nightmares. And like, what are some things that I can do about like this is happening when I'm sleeping. Obviously my body is like regurgitating old stuff, old stories, and it's trying to find resolve in my dream state. So how do I work this energy out of my body when I'm in, when I wake up from a dream like this?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I think it's important to note that there's a lot of people who do experience this because of exactly what you said of like, it's this like restful space that all this other stuff can come up. Like, it's not like that stuff isn't there during the day and then just pops up during the night. So there's space for that to happen. And really it's an indicator of where the energy is stuck in your body. And so you seem to have like a pretty vivid idea of like what's happening in these dreams, how you feel. Like there's an awareness of like, okay, I was, you know, hypervigilant. I was this, I was that, or whatever. And so if you're in my office and we're working through this, we would probably just similar to like what I was saying with Rachel is like, if we could imagine we're back in that conversation with your mother-in-law, but in this case, if we're in this dream, like if you could go back into that, whether it's from last night or whatever, if you can feel like you're in that situation again, what would we notice? What's happening in your body? Like, even as you reflect on the dream, it's like, oh, maybe my heart is starting to beat faster, or my face is starting to flush, or I notice that my legs are bouncing or whatnot. You seem to have like, what you're talking about here is going like, I'm being misunderstood. I'm being told that like I'm manipulative or a liar or whatever. Like, as you were talking to me, like what came up in my body was like a big, like, no, like stop it. Right. And like in, you know, like pushing away, like I had that hand movement. I don't know if that resonates or not for you, but like,
it definitely does.
Okay. Yeah.
This like, no, why don't you fucking listen to me? Like, I'm telling the truth. This is against my character. Like, you know, like wanting to almost like shake them and be like, fucking listen.
So what I would do, if it's okay, is like, you just had some hand motions there where that you were kind of balling your hands up into fists and shaking them back and forth. And what I would say is like, can we just keep your hands like this? And if you need to slowly move them back and forth and notice what comes up in your body. Like notice how that wants to shift, if there's anything else that wants to happen. I'm still feeling like that big no.
Yeah, I know. It's so deep in my chest. Like that's wild. I mean, the last time I had one of these dreams was probably 4 months ago. And I'm like, wow, it's so crazy how you can just like drop right into that feeling of like, when I do this motion, like I feel like I'm in that dream state.
Yeah.
Like, emotional state I was in.
What would you want to say? Like as we have this movement that's going on, what is coming up intuitively? Doesn't have to make logical or rational sense. Just notice what's wanting to come up.
It's a feeling of like wanting to express my truth and not have it questioned. And so it's not even like, I don't even want to like shake the person or like tell them they're a bad person. It's more just like, there's this like deep need of like standing firm without and like needing to defend.
Yeah. What would that look or sound like?
Being able to hold my ground and say like, this is the truth of what is happening, and whether you agree with it or not, or believe it or not, it is what is happening. So I'm just going to do that.
How would you say that? Like, how would you want to say that?
Honestly, like scream it. Like scream it. Like,
Can you?
Well, I'm not going to do it on the podcast, but yes.
Could you? I mean, if you wanted to, could you mute yourself for a moment and give yourself a moment?
Okay, I'm going
to
mute myself because I don't want to
do it.
I don't want to blast my listeners.
Yeah. Yeah.
Guys, this feels so crazy to do this on air right now.
That's okay. I mean, only if you're okay with it.
I think I'm going to do this later because I feel like there's a lot that's totally going to come up and I want to stay present with this, but I'm going to go back.
We can't to this have app. You spiraling.
Yeah. I don't want to spiral, but like, I will go back to this when we're finished recording and I'm going to work through this because I feel like I have enough resources internally to keep myself unstable ground when I go through this. So I like, this is something that I wouldn't necessarily recommend someone do if they've never done somatic experiencing before.
Yes. Which is the only reason why I was like, go with it.
Because a lot did start coming up for me. So like just being mindful of that as we're entering these like body practices is like a lot may come up.
I don't know what's on the side of you, but it looks like maybe a door or window. Is that?
Yeah, it's a window.
Oh. So maybe just take a second and either look out there or around the space that you're in and just find something that your eyes would like to settle on. And just let your eyes receive that and take it all the way into your body. Noticing if that helps to just create a little bit more space or deepening of the breath. Feel a little bit grounded in your seat, wherever you're sitting. Just so that we can come back to like the present moment. Yeah.
I think that's important to note too. Like as we talk about this, it's like, we don't want to go into this super deep activated state every time we do this work. Sometimes it's just really grounding and helpful to orient to your space.
Yeah.
And your body.
And so what we did there is, okay, so it was the last episode where we talked about like the difference between single incident and complex trauma. And we talked about this idea of integration, right? So it's not that we can go back to every single incident that ever happened to us. There's just way too many. But what we're doing right there is what is integration. So we had this moment of activation. Mm-hmm. And then we brought ourselves back down.
Yeah.
And I can trust that you'll take care of yourself, like maybe by yourself or with a therapist or whatever, to kind of complete that. But what you just experienced there is I had this moment of activation where maybe traditionally I would go even more activated or where I would shut down completely. And instead we had this moment like a wave where it kind of like swelled, but it didn't get out of control. And then we came back down into the present moment. So we're teaching your body to like expand its capacity for distress or uncomfortability. Not that we want to live in that spot, But what that helps our bodies do is learn, like, oh, that scary thing can happen, or I can feel that, you know, distress or discomfort in my body, but it does not have to overwhelm me.
Yeah.
I can still come back to the present moment and I can feel safe internally and externally. Or at least I hope that's where we're landing.
Absolutely. And I love that you just walked me through that real time. So like my listeners can like kind of experience a little bit of like what this work feels like and what it feels like. Like I just went through a very miniature version of like what a session would look like. You know, I'm bringing forth like, hey, I'm having these bad dreams. And you're like, let's go into that. How do you feel? What is a physical motion that you're doing in this dream? Like, you know, walking me through that, I'm getting more and more activated, but I'm not going into the full point of activation where I am spiraling and collapsing and overwhelmed. I think that in my experience with therapy, traditional therapy, like talk therapy, it was always very, I would just like talk about my trauma and get really worked up and like upset. And then there would, it'd be like, okay, well, the time's up. See you next week. You know, there was zero resolve. And I remember coming out of it feeling way worse every single time, feeling like all my pieces were hanging out of my body. And I had to figure out how to put it all back in. And, you know, being like a massage therapist, I may be going to therapy and then going straight to work in this super activated, disorganized space. And, what I found is so powerful about somatic experiencing is it not only helps you work through this stuff, but it also brings you back to a state of like presence and like you complete that cycle and you rest. You go back to the rest and digest by doing things like the orienting practice we just did, where you had me look out the window and find something that I could really like bring my attention to for a minute.
Yeah. And I think that's why, I know this wasn't a question that you asked, but I think it's why it's so important, like to, if you're doing this work, to work with somebody who's trauma trained, not just somebody who's trauma informed. Like anybody can be trauma informed, whether that's like the person who's ringing you up at the grocery store or your therapist or whomever. And it's really lovely that there's more and more people that are practicing, that are bringing into their lifestyles and their professions that trauma-informed piece. But that does not necessarily mean that they know how to get somebody out of an activated space. There's many therapists even that would say, I'm super trauma-informed and I can understand that trauma plays into like this or that or this symptom or that, whatever. But then they go, okay, so just talk about it. And they get their clients super duper activated and they don't know how to get their clients down from that. They don't know how to help their clients create a sense of internal safety and a feeling of being in the present moment. So we look for somebody who's trauma trained, who actually has the training to notice like physiological cues of activation and where their client might flip over that line into being like way out of their window of tolerance. And regardless, whether it's way out or, you know, less out or whatever, can bring them back to safety, can bring them back to a place of feeling grounded and present. And like you said, not walking out like completely raw and exposed and like anything could happen and I will just like fall apart.
Yeah. Thank you so much for that. That's, I think that if more of us are informed on what to look for in a therapist, we will be able to advocate for ourselves much better and be able to find the right mental health professionals to like work with us. I mean, and this even goes for like body workers. If you're doing body work, you know, being trauma-informed is helpful. I call myself a trauma-informed therapist. I've, you know, done all the reading and, you know, gotten all the mentorship and taken the classes, but it wasn't until, my mentor started working in somatic experiencing that things completely shifted, for her practice. And then she started, kind of demonstrating and like mentoring me through this of like how to support clients, when they're coming in a really activated state and get them to a place of presence so that they can safely drop into their bodies and safely experience touch, in a way that won't be super activating and can be more restful. And so I've been integrating that into my work and it has been game changing. The results that we're getting, the clients, the rest that they're able to access, the safety they're able to access within themselves, just being trauma informed was like, mm-hmm. oh, this client acted out because of this probably triggered them. And it's like, okay, like that's good to know, but how do we even avoid that happening in the first place? And how do we work our way back down if that happens, you know? And that's been really powerful as a practitioner to kind of shift into this new way of working. And I'm really excited to get my training. I'm like waiting for the next cohort to start so I can sign up.
Yeah. Yes. That's awesome. You said you're in St. Louis, right?
No, I'm in Louisville, Kentucky.
Or Louisville. Yeah, sorry. So they just switching.
So their Florence, Kentucky cohort just had their first training and the Nashville just did their first training. So she's in the Nashville cohort. So I think I have to wait like 2 more years.
Okay.
And then they'll come back around.
Yeah. Yeah, probably. I mean, they are always starting them. Mm-hmm. So keep your eyes out, you know, but one of my best friends is an assistant in the Nashville cohort and it's an awesome, the whole cohort, like the lead teacher and they're great. So they're getting great education for sure.
Well, it's changing the way like our studio is running now. It's incredible. Yeah, it's really, really beautiful work, but it is, it's definitely something, it's a 3-year-long program. So
it's intense. It's intense. It's a big commitment. I'm so grateful that I went through it. It's life changing.
Yeah. I'm ready to do it. I want to go do it.
Love it.
Hey, we know that deconstructing religious trauma is hard and can feel heavy when you're doing it on your own. We get it. We're right here with you in this process. The one thing we can always go back to is getting quality therapy with a licensed mental health professional. Thank you to BetterHelp for sponsoring this episode. BetterHelp is the world's largest leading therapy service, and it's 100% online. With BetterHelp, you can tap into a network of over 25,000 licensed and experienced therapists who can help you with a wide range of issues. To get started, you just answer a few questions about your needs and preferences in therapy.
That way, BetterHelp can match you with the right therapist from their network. Then you can talk to your therapist however you feel comfortable, whether it's via text, chat, phone, or video call. You can message your therapist at any time and schedule live sessions when it's convenient for you. If your therapist isn't the right fit for any reason, you can switch to a new therapist at no additional charge. With BetterHelp, you get the same professionalism and quality you expect from in-office therapy, but with a therapist who is custom picked for you. You'll have more scheduling flexibility at a more affordable price. Get 10% off your first month at betterhelp.com/cheers. That's better. HELP.com/cheers.
So we want to bring this into some listener questions. And it's so interesting that both Rachel and I brought real life examples to you to work through. And both of us, our examples had to do with interpersonal relationships. Hers having to do with her mother-in-law kind of like drilling her about the podcast and about her beliefs in God and how she's raising her child. And then mine having to do with like past traumas of dealing with my family members and being gaslit and controlled and all of that. And so a lot of our listener questions have to do with how to maintain relationships with people who are still in high control groups and religious groups. A little bit of it has to do with like kind of resolving like the cognitive dissonance. So we'll just get into it.
Sounds great. All right.
So our first question is from Edith. And Edith says, how do you effectively encourage someone who is fully caught up in a harmful movement or cult to begin to question their environment?
Okay. So first of all, I think it's important that this is probably for all the questions because they're of the interpersonal nature. Like there's things that may or may not work for you or for a different person just based off of relationships. So everybody's different. We'll just say that. So what works for you may or may not for the next person and vice versa. But in terms of like, how do I encourage somebody to question? You know, it's really hard because I'm assuming this person probably has their own background in high control religion. And so that's where we can like gain a sense of empathy. And I think that's really important because as much as like being on the outside of it, we can look back and be like, oh my God, how did I believe that? Why did I not question that? Why did I think this? Like while we were in it, so many of us never did that. We thought this was the way, the truth, the life, right? Like we didn't have a reason to question it. And so I think if we can use empathy, like, or lead with empathy of going like, I can understand why somebody would be so hesitant or resistant to be questioning these things, I think that can give us more of a posture of curiosity versus like, you must question these things. But the other thing I would say is like, is this person even open to it? Right. You know, I know we talk a lot about how consent was not taught in purity culture as it pertains to like sexual activity, but consent wasn't taught at all. Like, and consent goes far beyond things, just sexual things. And so I think we have to also be recognizing that some people may not be interested in questioning. They may not be interested in having conversations. And if they're indicating that, it probably would be actually a really telling example to respect that, right? Like, to not force somebody to question, and to just live your life according to your values. And, you know, like I think about for myself, I've become so much of a, like a kinder person, a more compassionate person, a less judgmental person. And that shows in the way that I interact with people. And it shows in my conversations, and it shows in how I respect when somebody says, that's not something I'm interested in. And I can say, okay, because it doesn't mean anything about me personally. They're sharing with me their boundary, and it would behoove me to respect it. And so I think that when we talk about consent and then kind of like leading by example, like, if somebody is interested in having those conversations, go for it. But if they're like, I'm not questioning, that's not even interesting to me, what would it be like then to respect that and to just simply show up in your highest value with maybe kindness and compassion and leading with non-judgmentalism and just be yourself? And maybe they'll have questions about it. Like, wow, you've changed a lot. You're way nicer, but you're not religious. How does that work together? Like, I've literally had people say that. I don't get it. Why are you so much kinder now than you were when you were supposed to be a Christian or whatever? So I'm not saying that that's easy to do that, but I'm not getting from the question, at least how it was phrased, I'm not getting that this other person is actually even like interested in having conversations. And if they're not, then I would say they communicated to you a boundary. And what would it be like then to respect that? Now, if they have come to you and said, I do want to ask questions, then I would say, could we create a safe space to allow those questions? And that might include you, whoever this question asker is, of like being responsible or being in charge to like keep your own nervous system regulated, recognize when you're getting triggered, recognize when their questions or their resistance to maybe something that you've said is kind of getting you activated. And what do you need to do to be able to stay safe and grounded and connected to that person? We're not looking to argue or prove points. How do we remain in conversation? So it might mean I have to take a break. It might mean that I have to like just, you know, like say, hey, can we just like breathe together for a second here? It could mean a lot of different things, but if they're inviting the conversation, I would say, keep it a conversation and take care of yourself so that you're staying safe so that you can continue to employ both conversation and curiosity.
I love that answer. Because I feel like a lot of our listeners are still in the evangelizing phase of being out of Christianity, yep, where they like want to evangelize everyone in the opposite direction. So I think that talking about boundaries and consent is really important as we are working on our own healing, because, you know, we didn't learn boundaries and consent growing up. That was not a thing. And so being able to access that in our lives firsthand, as we're dealing with people in our everyday lives who are maybe still quite involved, being able to create our own boundaries and saying, hey, I'm not comfortable talking about your religion. It makes me really uncomfortable. I prefer if we just change the topic, and enforcing that boundary and like, but still having an active relationship with that person, that can speak volumes.
Yeah, absolutely.
I think it's really hard when you've discovered the truth, your truth or whatever, that this religion is harmful and all the harm it's doing. It's really hard not to want to just tell everyone that, you know, and be like, absolutely, what are you doing? This is, you know, don't do this anymore. Like, and I know it's hard, but at the same time, if someone's not open to hearing it, they're not open to hearing it. You know, like, you're only going to frustrate yourself by continuing to try to cause them to question stuff. Mm-hmm. As we know, deconstruction is its own journey. We all have gotten there in different ways. And so consent is important because you are kind of no better than the Christian who's trying to evangelize you and tell you that your beliefs are wrong. You know, I'm not saying that you're wrong for wanting to do that. I feel the same way. I want to like shake my mom sometimes and be like, you are just following the hive mind of your little culty group and you're just saying things and you don't even know why you're saying them. And it's like, but that's the whole thing. It's critical thinking. And that is not something we do in religion. And I know it's hard though. I know it's hard. So our next question is from Jessica. And Jessica says, sometimes I wonder if I ever would have began deconstruction if I had not realized I was gay, thus becoming a targeted minority. My empathy evolved. Is there hope for the white, cisgender, straight family and friends who insist on rejecting critical thinking?
Yeah. Oh, I'm so sorry. Cause I know this is unfortunately common. Like it just is. I know for me, one of the first things really that caused me to start questioning is watching the treatment of people in the LGBTQ community and having close friends who identified as such and being like, I just can't get on board anymore with like somehow God made you desirous of a relationship with this person, but sorry, you can't have that. Like to me, that was just like, no, I can't get on board with that anymore. And so in regard to like that idea of like, is there hope? Like, is that ever something that they are going to come around to? I mean, the hopeful part of me wants to say, yes, of course they will, right? And yet I also know that it's probably not accurate to say that with like finality or with certainty. I have so many friends who are dealing with that, you know, whose parents are choosing theology and religion over their own child. And it's absolutely devastating to witness because it is so incredibly painful and confusing, and it doesn't have to be like that. And so, you know, I think a lot of times, like I am thinking of one friend in particular. I'm so proud of him. Like he's really had to put boundaries with his family, and his boundaries are awesome. They're flexible depending on what the situation is. So there's time periods where he can have minimal to no contact. And then other times where he's able to like, because his parent or parents are responding differently, where he can have a little bit more contact, and he's had to grieve that. And he's had to grieve the fact that his relationship with his parents will never be what it is that he had hoped for. And then he's also then found other people, including like extended family members, that have embraced him fully and wholly, where he's created this other family. And so I know that's not easy or possible for everybody, but I want to like, as much as I'd love to say like, yes, they'll get on board. We don't know, but that doesn't mean that you're not deserving of relationships. And it doesn't mean that those shouldn't be important. And there are so many people that are ready to stand in as a surrogate parent and a surrogate sibling and to come around and have like a created family. And I don't mean that in like a silver lining type way. I mean that there's literally people who go, I want you to feel connected and I want you to feel loved as a family. And I know it's not the exact same, but there is that. And so, you know, I think boundaries can be really helpful in situations like that. And I would also say like to still continue to show up to be yourself. Like, in the way that feels important to you. So that may mean you don't tell your family like all the nitty gritty details of your life, but it also doesn't mean you have to hide who you are. And so I think finding a balance can be really helpful. What feels safe to bring into a space with them. And maybe that's nothing for right now. That's okay. In a year or 10 years or whatever, it might be different. You might say it does feel safe to show up to this or that, or I can, you know, whatever I can bring my partner even to this family function, but go with where you're at right now. And if it does not feel safe to show up as yourself, it might be okay to take a break.
Yeah. Safety is like the most important thing. I feel like that's at least where I'm at with my family, even though I haven't come out as gay or anything that's not the norm, because family is so heavily religious and lacking boundaries and, you know, like interrogating you on your faith. It feels better to not be around them as much. And my family doesn't like that. you know, as of now. Right. They want to be so involved. They want to, you know, they want to see you weekly. And you're just like, this isn't working for me. You know, you come into my house and you question my beliefs. Okay. Yeah. Sorry. This is my safe place.
I had to go through a little bit of a, I wouldn't call it a breakup, but I definitely took a really big break from my relationship with my mom over Christmas. Because I needed time to figure out how I was going to continue my relationship with her moving forward, because in my whole life, it's been very like, she just knows everything about my life. There's no boundaries. And she makes it very clear how she feels about everything that goes on in my life. And, there was just kind of like this over, it's like overkill of like, you know, feeling like this need, like I have to tell her this thing about myself, but it's not, I don't feel safe telling her, and her reaction to it was not what I wanted or needed at that moment. And it caused me to feel really activated and unsafe. And then it took me 3 weeks to come down from that. And like, there was a lot of this that was happening. And, so I took, some time away from that relationship. And then when I returned, we had a conversation in which I was like, hey, over Christmas, I noticed that these things happened and this is how it made me feel. And I'm recognizing that this kind of dynamic we have is no longer healthy for me, and it's not going to push our relationship forward. And what I feel like would work for me is these boundaries. And if they are not respected, this is what our relationship will look like. And of course she fought it. Oh my gosh. She fought it. It was a fight. There was a lot of emotional manipulation, and I was like, wait a minute, you're doing it right now. That thing that I said that I don't want you to do anymore, that's not working for me, you're doing it right now. Well, I'm not doing it. I'm just trying to say my side. I understand. But you saying your side is emotionally manipulative to this situation, because I've told you that these things don't work for me. And so it was like, this conversation was very dynamic. There was a lot of ups and downs. It was like 2 hours, and I just maintained like, I was just very regulated in my body because I'd taken all that time away. And I knew that what I needed was real. And I knew that she was capable of, you know, providing that. And I knew that she was, if she wanted to have a healthy relationship with me moving forward, she would step into that. And I reiterated that this is me trying to have a relationship with you. Do you understand that this is me desperately wanting you in my life? Mm-hmm. But we just need to change the dynamic, because what's happening is not working. So it really worked out. I don't talk to her half as much as I used to, which is sad. I sometimes miss it. But at the same time, I feel so much safer. I'm living my life the way that feels most aligned for me. And she doesn't have to know all about it. And I went home and visited the family about a couple weeks ago when we had to reschedule our last recording. It was a really positive visit. I watched her get really activated and triggered by things and go through her whole thing. And I just was able to stay in my body and stay present and just be like, oh, that doesn't involve me. And oh, like, it's so interesting that my mom doesn't know how to, you know, she doesn't feel safe around, you know, these people or in this kind of situation, watching all this take place. And at one point I told her, I was like, I really want you to know that A, I had a really good time with you. But B, you have permission to feel what you're feeling and set your boundaries, because it seems like you were reacting to something and it was a lack of boundaries that you were reacting to, that you need more boundaries. And she was like kind of looking at me like, what? I'm like, you remember that conversation we had a few months ago? Like, you need to have that same conversation with this family member now, you know? So
exactly.
It was really... it was necessary, and it's really painful and hard in the process of creating these boundaries with people, but it can really heal a relationship if the other person is willing and able.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah. That's awesome. I love that example.
So we have time for like one more question. Sure. And this is, it just goes right into like what my example was. So this is from Hillary. How do you persuade someone, especially the elderly, who have been steeped in their own world for years, to stop jumping on a very human reaction and start looking at their behavior that caused the reaction in the first place? How do you encourage true self-reflection and not just self-entitled self-justification. So this is exactly what I was experiencing with my parents, mm-hmm. which is, you know, I said something and then they were like, well, we don't agree with that. And like went ballistic. And I was like, whoa, what you just did is not okay. And they're like, well, I only did that because, you know, mm-hmm. so how do we, maybe not persuade is the right word, but like, how do we converse with someone and encourage, that process of self-reflection?
Yeah, it goes a little bit to the first question also, because we have to have mutual willingness in order for this to happen. So for, as an individual though, like one of the, in my mind, one of the best things you can do is take care of yourself and learn how to stay self-regulated in a situation like that. So what are the things that you need to do so that you can continue to feel safe, present, and engaged if you want to be in that conversation, right? So let's say this is a conversation that you're like, I want to have this, like, this is fine. I feel good. I'm going into this, but what do I need so that I can stay regulated so that if they're getting activated, I'm not matching that activation. Oftentimes, well, so as humans, I believe we're created for relationship. And one of the things that happens within relationship, and it's not even deep relationship, just like when we're in the presence of other humans, we have this process called co-regulation. And that means like we use each other's nervous systems to help us regulate ourselves. And that could go really high. So we see somebody comes in, they're super duper anxious and we match their anxiety and then they get a little bit more anxious. So we get more anxious and then they get more anxious. So that can happen, or we can go the other way where somebody comes in with anxiety and I'm going to remain really, really regulated and I'm going to be paying attention to my physiological cues so that I stay present and grounded and safe. And then I notice that they start to come down a little bit, maybe not so anxious, and I stay grounded and safe and they might come down a little bit more. And so I think that can happen within like this context too, with family members of good. Like if I'm committed to taking care of myself, that I'm going to notice when I'm triggered, I'm going to notice when I'm activated, I am not going to depend or require somebody else to not trigger me, to not make me activated, because quite honestly, anybody could do anything that would make us activated. And they're maybe not even trying to, they're just showing up in the world. If I can be responsible for that and stay regulated, sometimes, especially if this is like a pattern, we can get that person to start to match our nervous system rather than us coming up and matching theirs, their own activation. I think that's really important to notice. Now, sometimes that has to happen many times before that person starts to kind of come down a little bit. If we're in this pattern of going, well, I say this, and then you say this, and then I do this, and then you do this, right? Like it's a pretty well-worn dance that we're doing where we're just getting each other more and more activated. So if that's the pattern, if that's how we're dancing and we want to shift that dance, it's going to take some time and some consistent interaction where I'm not getting activated. I'm not blaming. I'm not throwing it back in your face. I'm going to stay calm and regulated and present. And it's like I'm subtly inviting you to join me in that space. Now, you may be in relationship with somebody who just has zero ability to go there, who just maybe due to their own past or their stubbornness or like wanting to win or whatever, where they just may not ever be capable of doing that. And if that's the case, then for you, we go back to that question of what do you need in order to stay safe and engaged with them? And so it may be that you have to have a conversation that says, hey, grandma, I'm so sorry. Like, I love you, but like, I notice when we start talking about this, we get into it with one another and I leave feeling really disconnected from you, or I leave feeling like you've just hit me with a bus or something like that. And I'm really not interested in that. So I'm going to ask you, can we please take this off the table? Or I'm going to let you know that maybe I'm not going to share this part of my life with you anymore. And that's not because I'm trying to hide it from you. I just notice that it always causes disconnect or division or arguments. And that's where we would set a boundary. But in other cases, we have people who are going, oh, I do value relationship over being right, but I'm not used to how to do this. And if they're willing to kind of engage in learning a new pattern of communication and relating to you, that's awesome. That's really great. So yeah, I guess I'll pause there. I don't know if there was more to that question or any other questions that like came up as a result of that, but, But yeah, there's just kind of a few different ways you might work with that.
I was raised in a cult. Of course, if you'd have asked me all those years ago or anyone else in our small fundamentalist church if we were a cult, we'd have indignantly replied, absolutely not. Other groups like the Mormons or Jehovah's Witnesses, they're cults, but we're not a cult. Everything became normalized, though, but it wasn't until decades later, after I deconstructed my entire belief system and walked away from the Christian faith entirely, that I began to see just how cultish the whole thing actually was. But before all of that, for over 20 years, I'd served both as a pastor and a Bible college teacher, so I had a hand in it, furthering the toxicity also. So in the process of rebuilding my life and discovering my authentic identity, I've got lots to work through, things like religious trauma syndrome, rapture anxiety, and just so much more. Join me, Dr. Clint Haycock, on the Mind Shift podcast as we take a look at such topics as cult tactics and psychology, religious trauma syndrome and religious addiction, taking your life back after leaving a cult or high control group, and finally, dominion theology and the dangers posed by the Christian right, not just in America, but indeed the world. You can find my show on iTunes, Podbean, Spotify, or anywhere else you get your podcasts. Who knows, it might just be time for a mind shift.
No, I think that makes sense. And that little dance you talked about was very relatable as well. Things that we don't realize we do with people and where they kind of like activate you and you activate them. So it's good to be aware of that as well. But I do think that question to some extent, like you said, goes back to the first thing where it's like, if there's no opening there, if there's no consent, if there's no, you know, questions, I guess, to some extent, you kind of just have to stay grounded and regulated in your own self and what you think and believe and not try to kind of like force that into someone else. And it's hard with elderly because they've, you know, believed this for so long.
Yeah.
Like it's hard for people to change at that age, you know, don't count on it, I guess.
And the other thing too, and this is actually not, this is no one person or age group in specific, but especially in high control religion or cults or systems like this, there is this idea of it's us versus them. And so under that, it's like the difference equals danger. So if you believe or do or think differently than I do, that is dangerous. And then we add on to that the component of religion that calls this your identity, right? And so I eat, sleep, breathe, everything is wrapped up in this religion. So this is who I am. And now you, whoever you is telling me that this is wrong or this is different or whatever. That means not only are you dangerous, but you're criticizing me as a human being, my identity. So yeah, you better believe I'm going to get puffed up and I'm going to fight back. Right. And that is a very human process that's related to our nervous system. Now that doesn't mean that's not a justification, nor is it like permission to like treat people how you want to, because there's ways that we can work with that and resolve that and regulate ourselves. But just to give some greater context of like, especially somebody who's held on to these beliefs for 5, 6, 7, 8 decades, right? Like it's not even necessarily you as the grandchild or the kid or the whatever that's like causing them to do this. They're believing that you're criticizing their very identity, and because you're different, that you are dangerous. So they're responding as if you are a threat. And if there's no openness to going, oh, my grandkid isn't a threat, or difference isn't dangerous, or whatever it might be, then go back to that first question, then we go, we have to just be okay with like keeping it to ourselves, like regulating ourselves and just showing up as ourselves, taking care of ourselves. And maybe that will lead to more conversation or maybe it won't. But we're also battling that too, that difference equals dangerous identity piece. And that can be really hard then to navigate relationships as a result.
Yeah. I think a lot of people who are formerly like in high control groups, they kind of take that. It's like the evangelism side. We take that with us. We're trying to convert everyone to our way of thinking. And we want everyone to see how dangerous their religion is, but it's not necessarily going to be helpful. And it's going to probably hurt us more than it may help them. And so it's super important for us to work through our own trauma and focus on ourselves and focus mm-hmm. on creating safety within ourselves, staying in our bodies when interacting with these people and learning how to implement boundaries when they're needed.
Yeah.
So I think it all kind of comes back to that conversation. Like every single one of these questions, the way you answered it was like, hey, what about you? What about mm-hmm. what, how are you feeling in your body when this is happening? Can you stay mm-hmm. present in your body when this is happening? Mm-hmm. You know, that's going to be really key. But unfortunately, we're all out of time. And Dr. Laura, we want people to be able to find you and work with you. And could you drop any information you've got and how people can do that?
Yes, I can, as I have a coughing fit. So I am on social media, Dr. Laura E. Anderson. That's my website. So drlauraeanderson.com or my social media. I think I'm on TikTok and Instagram. I also run the Center for Trauma Resolution and Recovery, which is technically an online coaching company. All of the practitioners have backgrounds in mental health and have advanced training in trauma resolution modalities like somatic experiencing, as we've been talking about. We practice as coaches because it makes it far more available to anybody, regardless of where you live. But all of the practitioners there specialize in working with folks coming out of high control religion with religious trauma, cults, adverse religious experiences, purity culture, spiritual abuse, all the things. So I always love to direct people if you're looking for support. We're also rolling out additional resources like courses and workbooks and seminars and all the things, trying to give a variety of resources to people for wherever they're at. And then we also have support groups as well. So that's traumaresolutionandrecovery.com, or you can find us at Trauma Resolution and Recovery on Instagram. And then I am coming out with a book that is available for pre-order. It's called When Religion Hurts You, Healing from Religious Trauma and the Impact of High Control Religion. And that'll be out in October, but it is available for pre-order wherever you purchase books. And it's my attempt at trying to create a resource that is supportive and hopeful, like instills hope. You know, coming out of systems that have done a lot of damage to us.
Awesome.
Thank you so much. And we're going to put all the info in the show notes. So if you need to send Rachel any of that info, any of those links for your book and things like that, make sure that she gets those so that our listeners can find these resources. It was fun. Siri tried to jump into the podcast there.
Yes. she dictated like a whole section of the conversation.
Yeah, just send me that. Exactly. Whatever your watch recording.
AI is over here like writing a transcript.
Yeah, great. Now we don't have to write one.
Yeah. Thank you so much for
thank you.
Coming on, for spending your time with us today on this beautiful Sunday, and for giving us just amazing tools. I feel so much more empowered and so much more like just confident in like approaching some of this stuff that can feel a little scary and daunting in a way that I know is going to help me feel a little bit more resolve in my body. So thank you so much for working with us today.
Yeah. Thank you for having me. It's been a pleasure for sure. Yeah. And I do want to make sure, Molly, are you feeling okay?
Yes, I'm feeling all right. Good. Yeah, I'm feeling
okay, good.
She's going to go scream now.
Yeah, I am.
I don't, well, yeah.
Scream. Happy screaming.
I don't want to leave you in a space of feeling raw and exposed. So that's very important.
And you know what? Yeah. It was good for me to be like, you know what? If I do this practice right here, right now, it will probably make me feel really raw and exposed.
And I love that you noticed that.
Being able to notice that and like be like, hey, you know what? Yeah. Actually, I've hit my window of tolerance.
Yeah,
and perfect. Let's bring it back down and we'll revisit this when my window of tolerance mm-hmm. is a little bit more available.
I love that. That's awesome. Yeah. Good. Good. Awesome. Good.
Well, thank you so much.
Yes. Thank you. I hope y'all have a wonderful rest of the day. And I will, I wrote a note here. We'll get all the links to you and everything, for all the things. So
awesome.
Right. Awesome. Right. Thank you. Hope the birthday party goes well.
Oh my gosh. I'm so excited. See, I'm going to be surrounded by my chosen family. I'm good.
All right. So, bye.
Have a good one. Bye.
Looking for a safe place to deconstruct? If so, I have the place for you. We have a Facebook support group, and if you're not in it, you should absolutely be in it because there's a lot of amazing conversations happening in this group. So If you are wanting to be in a community with others who are in the same deconstruction process, find us on Facebook, Cheers to Leaving Support Group. You can also click the link in our show notes and it will take you to that page. You can request to join, answer the questions, and become part of the conversation. We're looking forward to seeing you there.
Thanks for listening to Cheers to Leaving. We are seriously so glad you're here. Follow us on Instagram at Cheers to Leaving. Our sound and editing is by Cameron Smith. Please leave a rating and review on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and anywhere else you listen to podcasts. Please subscribe and share with your friends and others who may be deconstructing. You can also email us at cheerstoleaving@gmail.com with your stories about leaving evangelicalism. See you in 2 weeks.